listening to you talk about no sanctuaries and denied areas and WMD terrorism, I'm left feeling I need to ask, of the two, I would argue the two biggest issues that we're facing today, and many people may argue there are more than two, Iran and Pakistan, how do we see the priority between these two in terms of our alignment of what are still limited forces? And maybe even more importantly, do these partners, who are such a critical leg in this tripod, share our assessment of that priority? And how does that affect our ability to build this network, which is appropriately so dependent on our partners?
Well, I think we need to separate here the notion of what are really pressing strategic problems we currently have on our plate and the next administration will have on our plate, of which Iran and Pakistan are certainly two of the top, whatever your number is of N, a small number, but probably well more than two. And the issue of the relative challenge they pose in terms of immediacy or severity as well, along with other similarly serious problems, versus the issue you raised about being aligned with partners on various goals. So, for example, in using a global counterterrorism network to prevent attacks on the United States, you certainly have to worry about sanctuaries, whether they're in countries which are aligned with us or countries which are hostile to us. But you also have to worry about group actors elsewhere globally. Again, remember the 9/11 attacks. We had, you know, training and planning and lots of things going on in Afghanistan, but very important things going on in Europe as well. And that same phenomenon exists today. So it's not enough just to deal with the sanctuary or to have a strong partner in one country or a handful of countries, say, pick them. You really have to be stronger than your adversary in lots of places, and that's one of the fundamental challenges of this world, which is why, again, sort of leads you to the strategy, I think, that I talked about. So getting the Europeans, we have a very close counterterrorism partnership with our European partners, but they're an essential component of this for stopping attacks in Europe or stopping attacks that may pass through Europe to the United States. You know, again, it takes that multi-aspect approach. And then in a lot of sub-regions, whether it's the Arabian Peninsula, you know, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, UAE, et cetera, number of countries, or the Levant, or the Maghreb, they may pose sub-regional threats or threats beyond their region in some cases, generally not quite as much to the homeland as a couple of other regions, but they still, the same strategy is required, and you have to have those partners aligned. And again, I guess the one point I want to sort of emphasize is the critical relationships here is with us and perhaps a couple of other external partners in some cases, at least on the operational side, with the locals that really matters. And you add up those local partnerships, and that's what gets you the strategic effect around the world. Now, in things like donor assistance, you know, for specific countries that may be, you know, unstable and require assistance, then mobilizing a broad array of external partners to provide that assistance becomes critical. But there's no formula in terms of partnerships. Now, I don't know if I answered your question about Pakistan and Iran. I don't want to really get into anything current policy or operations, but across the world. But they're both pressing problems.
I expected the answer to that would be yes. AP right here. If you could all just speak into the mics at the middle of the tables. Thank you.
Thanks. Pam Hess with AP. Using your experience in Afghanistan with the program that eventually ousted the Soviets, what lessons can be drawn from that as people are trying to come up with how to handle the problem in the Fatah, and especially given the model that keeps getting bandied about with Anbar? What's applicable there, what's not, and what caution should there be?
Well, I've learned in irregular warfare and clandestine operations and other parts of this business that it's way more art than science, and you have to adapt it to specific conditions. It's hard to export one model to another area. But the problem that we faced in Afghanistan in the 1980s was the Red Army and other instruments of Soviet power occupying another country. And so, you know, it took an industrial strength approach to get them out. One of the big lessons of that conflict and great success, I think it was decisive in helping, not the only element by far, but decisive in bringing an end to the Cold War, was not to declare victory and go home. That, you know, if there, what Secretary Gates has said this, if, you know, there's something we could do over as a country, it would certainly be not to have the hiatus we had with Afghanistan and Pakistan after the Cold War. So I think that's one lesson strategically that's been internalized. Operationally, you know, it's a part of the world, the broader region where you know, everybody has a gun, and you know, it's part of the culture, and so local security is sort of the way of doing business, and so, you know, that creates operational prospects, you know, in various areas. And but the broad strategy of the necessity of dealing with partners, doing some things that we might do, and then being willing to work with formal institutions of a government and those who might not be part of a government but might be very helpful is pretty central to these kinds of operations.
At the back, Mike.
Brian Catula, Center for American Progress. You mentioned briefly your criticisms about the idea of a new style OSS being developed. I thought maybe you could offer a little bit more insight as to why you don't think that wouldn't necessarily be the best model for going forward. And then, looking at the next administration, what types of large initiatives do you think they need to dedicate more resources to on the intelligence front?
Okay. Well, I'll answer the first question. I don't think I want to tackle the next one. But the reason I think another OSS isn't the right model is, if I understand it correctly, it means creating something out of nothing. We've got something. You know, it's had greater successes and lesser success, but had a lot more successes than people think, and it's doing critically important work around the world today. And if it also means putting that organization inside the Department of Defense, as the OSS was, I'm not sure that's the right approach. And we're at war. I mean, not only do I think we're doing a lot better than people think in some of these areas, but the idea that the first thing I would want to do in the middle of a war right now, and with some of the threats you described, to come in and say, let me figure out how I can play musical chairs here and reinvent new institutions, doesn't strike me as the wisest approach. So I'm not sold on the specifics. I don't think we need to, for instance, some have suggested combining our special operations forces in the same organization. With the Central Intelligence Agency, if that's what they mean by OSS, so, you know, I've seen that variant. We don't need to do that. We get the, you know, again, we might need more integration than we have today in some areas. We can achieve that. So I guess I'm just generally leery of organizational solutions to problems. I'm much more a believer that the people you have in certain positions, you know, basically there's two ideas you can do in an organization. You can make it very difficult to wield power, or you can make it easier to wield power, right? Our founding father said, we want to make it difficult for you. As we became a great power, we created institutions in World War II, and then following that, you know, National Security Act of 1947, to make power more easy to wield. That doesn't mean that every occupant of those positions or the organization performs at optimum all the time. What it means is you have the organizational capacity, if the time is matched and the person is matched, to get it done. I think we have the institutions we need. I think we need to focus more on getting the right people in them and making sure those organizations are resourced and have the authorities and capabilities they need than, you know, rejiggering things. Some organizational reforms I think were necessary. I think the Department of Homeland Security, for example, was something where consolidation. Now, you know, again, if you look at our organizational history as a government after World War II, it took time to build the Department of Defense to what it looks like today. It just didn't happen in a year or so, and it will be true for any other organization. But that consolidation was very important, and you know, it may take a decade or more to really get it working the way it should. But I guess I'm very skeptical of remaking the CIA or remaking this or that. Again, just a personal view, but an insider one. Yeah. Oh, you're supposed to.
Go ahead. We'll get there. I'm Bob Dreyfus with The Nation magazine. John Brennan, who's got some experience in intelligence and counterterrorism, sure, has told me, but a lot of other people, that he thinks that even the words global war on terrorism are terrible, and that too often people are now all over town saying we're using a hammer to fight a nail when we have other tools besides hammers. Now, you seem to represent the hammer side of the equation. Are you ready for a new boss who might say, hey, we're going to take a whole new approach to this? And is our institutions of, you know, military and intelligence prepared to be reorganized from top to bottom on a new method, a new strategy, new ideas?
Well, I think our institutions, you know, understand democracy and understand civilian control, and you know, however new leadership wants to reorganize it, that's their business. I don't think what I was describing would be described as a hammer approach. If an intelligence and foreign assistance and working with partners in many countries with which we're not at war, and I would emphasize that, not at war, but joined with them against terrorists, I think John Brennan and I would actually describe that the same way, whatever you call it. As far as the name War on Terror or the Global War on Terrorism, you know, again, I'll leave that to others. There are a lot of choices one has to make. If you take that apart, some people say the only world we can all agree on there is the, and after that, you know, we have arguments. But if you take it apart and say, do I like the word war or not, and what do I mean by that? Well, clearly we don't necessarily mean big military operations or anything else. We may mean the non-military part is dominant. It's 98%. But does the word war add some value in terms of law enforcement or criminality versus, and again, if you look at Al-Qaeda's aims, they look like war aims to me. They don't look like criminal aims. But you know, again, that's for others to decide. I think most would agree it's global. I hope there's not as much dispute about that. The global part frequently gets dropped off, but that doesn't mean it's everywhere all the time in the same strength. It just means that it takes advantage of globalization. And then if you look at the terror aspect, I mean, clearly terrorism is a central phenomenon. People argue semantically, well, it's just a tactic, it's not this, fine. Sometimes euphemisms are rather useful in something in terms of not... and I'll just leave it at that. But I mean, as you wrestle with this problem, You know, again, as I say, each word has come to dispute, but, you know, have at it. It's just that people who have wrestled with this made deliberate choices for a variety of reasons, and one could go the other way, but, you know, it's not that they didn't think about it.
We have lots of questions, and I promise you I'm going to try and get to all of you. I had one right here.
Yeah, Ben Friedman from the Cato Institute.
Can you speak into the mic?
Yeah, Ben Friedman from the Cato Institute. I have a question about counterinsurgency doctrine in Afghanistan. According to Sean Naylor, you opposed the surge, or at least sending more troops to Afghanistan back last winter, and I appreciate that, and I agreed with you then and now. And I just wonder if you agree with me about something, which is, it seems to me that in the United States, we've now sort of conflated state building and counterinsurgency, and we've discovered, I think, in Iraq, another strategy of counterinsurgency, which is contrary to state building, which actually empowers people who are not committed to the state, which serves our goal, but maybe not the goals of the state we're operating in. And that seems to me an even better strategy for Afghanistan, which has never had powerful central authority, and yet everyone talks about Afghanistan as if our security depends on the success of that state. So I wonder if you could just comment on that and tell me if I'm wrong.
Those are separate ideas. I mean, one, the article you're referring to is more headline than substance if you look at the rest of it. It is a surge, meaning an Iraq replica, the right answer? And then my answer to that is no. Does that mean you can't have more forces of some kind? Are you surging if you go from something very small to something a little larger and your approach is still dominant the other way? Well, then, you know, I don't think we should get hung up on that. But I agree with you. I think, first and foremost, you have to take each of these cases on their merits. And to make it specific about Afghanistan, it is always better strategically and operationally to swim with the tide than to swim with against it. So you have to make an assessment of how governance structures will work, what the art of the possible is in a counterinsurgency context. In some other context, of course, different problems. But and that then should drive sort of the mix of instruments you bring to bear and their how much of it should be done by an indirect approach or through locals versus a direct approach. Again, you have to look at what's possible. In El Salvador in the 1980s, we fought a very successful counterinsurgency with a very, very small U.S. footprint, but a pretty big financial commitment and a lot of senior leader focus on the country. You know, and so there are varying different models that you have to apply in each case. And you know, Afghanistan will likely require additional resources of some kind. That may be assistance, that may be more supporting assets in some cases, it may be different strategies to empower more of the Afghan people. That is something that is under review, and I don't want to prejudge any outcome. And it's something undoubtedly the next administration will tackle as well. But we'll have success in Afghanistan if we remain engaged. It will require additional resources of one form. What those resources are, I think, will be determined.
Yes, right here.
Both presidential candidates have stressed the need to get bin Laden and Swahili, and they both have said they're going to do it. What will you tell the next president about the importance of getting the two terrorists, and what the key challenges they face in capturing the two?
Well, again, if you look at this problem as I do from a strategic and operational perspective, unless I'm talking about the tactical aspects of this guy is in this house and how do I actually deal with that, the principles are quite similar in a sense that my fundamental problem is to identify elements of the network. I have to be able to defeat a network, not just its senior leaders. Now, often I can, a way to collapse a network is to attack it from its top levels, not necessarily just the top, but different networks have different characteristics. And that I need a certain degree of persistence to do that. So whether, again, I'm talking about loosely affiliated networks around the world that subscribe generally to some common ideology and you have some core group that exploits it, or I talk about a much tighter network that's confined in one area, such as Pakistan border region, where I have a lot of senior leaders and planning and other things going on. It's not enough. One, it's very, very difficult to find any one person at any time. But it's not, even if you can, it's not enough to not attack the network. You've got to get the planners, the trainers. You have to take down the capability as a whole. And so while the top leadership has great symbolic value, leadership value, all sorts of unique characteristics resident in them, they don't represent the whole power of the organization. And it is a larger problem, I guess, is what I would convey than just them. And then if you look at it more broadly, as I said, it's those who support, either provide sanctuary to them or join common cause and fight with them, you know, even if they have common aims in any war, you know, you have allies of convenience and others, but you have that in some of these cases as well. And so it's important, depending on what each aspect, how they mutually reinforce each other, but whether some portions represent a threat to Pakistan or some to Afghanistan or some to the homeland, if you want to deal with all three problems, you got to deal with all portions of that network.
And right here.
Elaine Grossman with the National General Group. Just wanted to ask if you would bring us up to date on efforts by any terrorist organizations around the globe to acquire or build weapons of mass destruction, chem, bio, nuclear. So where are we in that? And if you could also just say a bit about international organizations' efforts to try and interdict any such movement of these weapons or materials. For instance, what's Interpol doing on that front?
Could you repeat the first part? I got them.
Just looking for a status update on efforts that have been conducted over the last year or two on the part of these groups to acquire or build weapons of mass destruction.
Well, a number of states and non-state actors are trying to acquire such weapons, and counterproliferation remains a critical mission of the government and our partners. The president's Proliferation Security Initiative, which again applies similar principles of trying to rally multiple partners to interdict and prevent the acquisition and movement of these weapons, if they are acquired, is really a critical strategic aspect of that. And then when you get into the area of specific countries or groups or others, then, you know, it becomes almost unique to each country. And that's about the most I can say about that.
Oh.
Interpol, I can't. I mean, I would if I could. That's not my area.
I'll direct you to some of the other speakers we've had in this series, including Rolf Moe Larsen, whose
sure.
statement
Much
is on the website and spoke that. Specifically on yep. this issue. Rafi.
Yep.
I'm Rafi Danziger from APAC. And there are those who say that what you are doing, the war of terror, is like going after fish, or at most the school of fish. But as long as the sea in which they swim remains intact, there will be other fish, or schools of fish will come up. And they say that that sea is the sea of ideas. And the real war is to be the war of ideas. The United States needs to persuade the people that what those terrorists and their supporters espouse is really not good for those people. Can you address that, and to what extent you were involved in that? interagency process is taking this into account.
Yes. Well, I mean, the war of ideas is a central element. I alluded to it briefly about sort of information operations writ large. It is an interagency problem. I do participate in those discussions and have oversight of a number of the capabilities as well. The fundamental problem is how you wage that war, or if you don't like the term war, for war of ideas, whatever that struggle or competition looks like, what themes you emphasize, how well they resonate, the distribution mechanisms, or who's giving the message, can determine success or failure. But not surprisingly, it may be something that takes a long time and is enabled by something else as well. When you look at the operational challenges that terrorists pose, you have more of an immediacy that you have to deal with as well. So I don't think you have a choice of just doing, the operational, or as I describe, sort of the war in the shadows versus the, a war of ideas. You have to do both, and which one ultimately gets you closer to victory, or whether they reinforce each other at varying points along, will be determined. But everyone recognizes it's important. It's not enough to say, then what I do about that realization? How do I implement that, and how do I protect myself while I'm implementing? And as I said, what you find sometimes is, you have to have people come to their own conclusions about whether this is good for them or not, how you get them to reach those. I mean, that's fundamentally a war of ideas, but it's a war of ideas in their own head about how they reach that I shouldn't harbor these people, or whatever the case is. A lot of instruments by which one could do it that aren't necessarily just informational. We get some of our greatest successes if you just try to measure images of the United States or whatever from acts rather than arguments in a lot of cases. We can talk till we're blue in the face a lot of cases, but when you do things like earthquake relief or others, you see that opinions change some. Now, whether that then has a strategic effect in the war on terror or has some other effect is another matter. So it's, it's something people wrestle with and will continue to wrestle with. It's this is analogous in some ways to the intellectual struggle we had in the Cold War. Many have argued that we did a lot better early in the Cold War than we're doing early in this war. They're very different, though. The population, there's just so many variables that are different. It's hard to say. So.
Okay. Ma'am, here in the front.
Yes. Ms. Sigmund, with the Office of the Secretary of Defense Policy. What is your vision for the cyberspace domain in general? I know you mentioned information operations, sir.
Please say it again.
Yes, sir. Cherry Sigmund, Office of the SecDef Policy. What is your vision of the role of the cyberspace domain in the GWAT?
Cyberspace.
In general, you mentioned info ops. What are you able to share with us?
Well, not much, but I'll try. Cyberspace in general is of growing and very significant strategic importance, whether it's various states around the world as an instrument to use, or whether it's non-state actors. Al-Qaeda and its affiliates do use the internet very effectively, as do others, as I alluded to, or the cyber domain, and it is because it's an emerging area of emerging in the sense that it hasn't been around that long of conflict. what's most effective, what policies we should adopt, legal frameworks, et cetera, you know, still represent to some degree a work in progress. And I think will for some time to come. It is a central battleground. And then if you nest that in the broader just information sphere of after an operation, I mean, some have argued that our adversary, you know, I talked earlier about how to try to operationally take apart a network, we will do operations just to generate intelligence to lead to a series of operations to then generate the effect we want. Some argue that a lot of our adversaries, you know, do operations just to support their information objectives, or use our operations to support their information objectives. That, you know, that, and they actually do very well in this area by making false claims, and, you know, and they have a lot of advantages if you just stack up competitors and you say, well, you can lie and you can't, and you can do this and you, you know, they play pretty well on that battlefield. And so both in the, you know, the cyber is a, for Al-Qaeda and others, it's a very important aspect of globalization. You know, again, if your strategy is, I want to catalyze this movement, I want to share my successes, I want to fire you up, do all that things, boy, you're a great tool that they wouldn't have had otherwise. And they use it rather well, and it's been a lot of growth in the past couple of years in that area.
Yes, sir.
Reuters. Oh, sorry. David Morgan with Reuters. Can you give us sort of a general assessment of the threats facing U.S. interests in Afghanistan and Pakistan, especially from a historical perspective? I mean, when you consider statements from top U.S. officials that Pakistan now faces an existential threat from Islamist militancy, and when you consider that Al-Qaeda is operating out of safe havens that are beyond the easy reach of U.S. forces, might it be said that the threats posed by that region of the world are greater now than they were, say, 10 years ago?
Okay. Well, the threat posed from Afghanistan 10 years ago was pretty serious, in a sense that it was a sanctuary for Al-Qaeda to, you know, develop the 9/11 attacks and earlier attacks before that. And as I mentioned, one of the lessons we took away from the Cold War, as Secretary Gates has said, is that we don't want to leave the prospect of failing states. And so whatever is the right destiny for Afghanistan, and that's fundamentally up to the Afghan people, however one defines our goals, we certainly don't want it to be a safe haven for terrorists and source of instability. The same true for Pakistan. In Pakistan, the problem has gotten worse over the past decade, substantially worse, as Al-Qaeda senior leadership fled from Afghanistan after our successful operations there in 2001. Late 2001, they have been very successful aligning themselves with local groups. They've married into a number of these groups going back 20 some years, but in other cases, local groups have become more militant and presenting an internal threat to Pakistan, reaching into the settled areas with bombings, I don't have to remind you, bombings, assassinations, and others. In the past year or so, Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri declared open war on Pakistan. They hadn't done that, I believe. Bin Laden hadn't. I think Zawahiri started very recently as well. And what is meant by existential threat is both the significant threat to Pakistani stability, judgment I share, but also it's the classic problem of, you know, I have this neighbor that I've had conflict with in several wars, and that's my fundamental strategic problem, and then I have this other problem in the other area that seems lesser. I've shaped a lot of my institutions to do this other. How do I realize that this may be the more dangerous or immediate threat to me right now? And then, of course, a number of these groups, several of them operating in that area, want like the way they had it in Afghanistan before and want to restore that. And so they pose a challenge to international strategy in Afghanistan and stability in Afghanistan. So it's a three-way problem that emanates from the border region in Pakistan, a threat to the American homeland and Europe, and or just basically globally, a global threat, I guess is the way to describe it, but including a homeland threat, a threat to Pakistan and a threat to Afghanistan. It's a very, very serious problem. And as I said, it's you know, I don't want to measure trends month to month or anything, but if one looked at, say, 2001 and 2007 or 8, the threat got a lot more serious than Pakistan. Afghanistan, it has ticked up since 2006 or so. Both the insurgents, the local insurgency, and then the cross-border aspect.
To talk about the ongoing discussion about Title 10 authorities versus Title 50 authorities. Title 10, of course, being the section of the U.S. Code where the authorities for DOD largely reside, Title 50 being the National Security Act and other authorities for CIA and other elements of the intelligence community. And particularly, I would think you'd have some insights at how this plays out in the covert action arena, where we have this elaborate mechanism set up to provide for careful management and oversight of covert actions in the National Security Act. But the definition of covert action excludes traditional military activities, and I wonder whether anything that DOD is doing in the counterterrorism realm is considered these days to fall within the definition of covert action, is treated as a covert action, and if not, can you reassure us that there are appropriate oversight and management mechanisms in place?
Well, I can't speak to every person's opinion who might have one, particularly outside the government. I can assure you that DOD does not do covert action. As you mentioned, covert action is an important instrument, but an instrument that must have oversight, and there are mechanisms to do that. In the Title 50 realm and in the intelligence realm that date back to 1947. The Title 10 or traditional military activities are just that. What is a traditional military activity has to evolve depending on the circumstances to varying degrees as new challenges are posed, for example, in cyber. But the boundaries normally established for covert action, which is, and again, I'm out of my depth here, is going to get into legal stuff that I got to stay away from. But the boundary for covert action is typically whether the U.S. government would acknowledge it or not. With a traditional military activity, that doesn't mean you can't conduct something what we describe as clandestine, which is also an intelligence term. But it means different things in different forms. But it's basically, we did a secret operation to rescue the hostages in Iran, 1980. Well, we don't want to tell the Iranians, we don't want to tell the world about that before we do it. But at some point, you know, it is U.S. troops going in under DOD authorities. We will acknowledge the secrecy of that operation, as, you know, as it becomes public or at the appropriate time. Covert action is something, you know, the U.S. government does not, and again, I'll get out of my depth if I go any more there, but DOD does not conduct covert action.
Okay, right here in the front, and I see people, I'm getting to you as quick as we can.
John Barry, Newsweek. Back in 2004, I think it was, Secretary Rumsfeld sent around one of his snowflakes, posing the question whether we were killing, capturing, or otherwise neutralizing more adherents to Al-Qaeda than were being recruited through the madrasas. If you were asked that now, how would you reply?
Well, it would be very difficult to measure globally. I think it's if I looked at, say, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, an organization, and foreign fighters going to join it, I would say clearly we're on the positive side of that curve by a long shot. I would also say that earlier I answered your question about the importance of taking a network approach rather than an individual approach. That doesn't mean you have to get every foot soldier to, or every wannabe who would join, to destroy a network or to shut it off. And so the metric of essentially, again, I'm hoping I escape my hammer reputation back here, but whether I'm going to kill my way to stopping this pipeline is probably not the right framework to begin with. But even in the kill or capture end of this business, how I achieve that, I mean, can change rather suddenly depending on how a network gets collapsed. In other words, if enough middle management or it looks pretty unsafe to join, you can stop a flow pretty soon. And it isn't like you, at that balance, at that moment, you were achieving your way to victory. But again, so depending on the level you look at it, specifically at that operational aspect, which again, I would probably argue with. The problem, again, I want to emphasize the idea of regeneration. And I talked about the strategy of smothering, which is, even if I did that and I achieved it, the problem with these groups is you got to sit on them for a long time until you basically convince those around them and others that this is a bad idea. Whatever mechanisms you bring to bear to do this, that's a protracted period. I mean, even when you take away their operational capabilities, if you look at Bader-Meinhof, Red Brigades, or other small little groups hung on for a long time in pretty sophisticated states. And, and why did they give up the ghost? Well, they partially did at the end of the Cold War, when the world collapsed around them. But, getting the right metrics for this and knowing how you're doing at any point in time is a challenge. I would say that, in some areas it's clear we're having a lot of success. And, Southern Philippines, as I said, Iraq against Al-Qaeda in Iraq, at least, operationally, and then and some others.
Okay. The yellow tie. Yeah.
Thanks. Dave Hamish, CIS. You made a quite a strong statement about the centrality of the CIA in all of this, and I don't think there's any debate about it. But you went on to characterize this as there's some problems in, the human element and things like that, but that nothing could be farther from the truth in terms of how central they are. I don't think anyone debates that. There's a question, and I'd like your assessment on this, on the role of the DNI, and in the process of building capacity, have we, for example, brought in other layers of bureaucracy that reduce degrees of freedom to operate, and are there new resources that are perhaps new enough, given the time it takes for case officers to be developed, that you have the capacity diminished in some sense because of the greenness running operations from Washington? I'd just like your assessment on that.
The last part was greenness from Washington?
In other words, the newness of people who are now becoming sort of handlers for people in the field who are having to go back for permission to do things in Washington with people who haven't had experience.
I don't think that's a correct statement, but all right, let me try to tackle that. What I was trying to say there was, from the framework that I was describing of how do we operationally get at these terrorists around the world that would do us harm, the Central Intelligence Agency is an essential component of our network. That doesn't mean they're the answer to all our problems or they don't have some problems, but they really do vital work in all their traditional areas, you know, analysis and collection and you know, and special activities. But there has been a significant expansion in this decade. It takes time to do that, to train people, to get them seasoned. Again, you know, I mentioned earlier that this area is a lot more art than science. I know there's at least one other former case officer in the room. You never know how good someone is going to be by looking at them in training or the best selection program or anything. You got to see them out in the field once or two tours or something, or maybe more, to really see what you have. And so that takes time. And so, you know, if you have a younger workforce by necessity because you're expanding it enormously and you're only bringing in new people, it may take time for that organization to mature. But but it's not the case that, at least I'm not aware of, green people in Washington, junior to senior people in the field who are hamstringing them or anything like that there or anywhere else. You know, the DNI broke up the DCI's job, took two parts of it over for, you know, for community management and resources, and then the PDB part and others, and left management of the CIA with the director. That's working. I mean, it's you know, again, it's an early reform. We'll have to see over a longer period of time, as with any of these major government reforms, but you know, I'll share my prejudice. I always think it's about the people you have in the jobs. I mean, we generally have pretty good organizations in the government, you know, it's, what's the alternative on the green, you know, if I have a younger workforce or something, I'm sure it as fast as I can, and if they're getting a lot of experience, they'll mature faster than they would otherwise, but you know, they still got to mature. So, but all I was trying to say was, one, they're central to the way we do business, and two, they're really doing a good job.
Okay, we have just a few minutes left and five or six questions, so we're going to try and bundle some together and try and get as many as we can. We had two over here. If we can take both your questions, and then we'll answer them together.
Ben Runkle-Brand. Pushing on the theme of capacity building as force multiplier, what do you see as the future, and that your 20% capabilities, what do you see as the future capabilities need for effective capacity building? Some argue that we need 20, 30,000 Army officers or Army personnel. Whereas others argue that the expanded SOF should, post Iraq, post Afghanistan, should return to their FDA origins.
Yeah.
Also within that, what internal limitations or legal restrictions and diplomatic restrictions need to be revisited and in the future possibly reworked? In CJTF HOA, they have difficulty training the regional coast guards because those technically under U.S. law come down as internal security forces, which therefore the Navy can't train, and they're similar there. SOC PAC runs into restrictions in the Philippines as far as force caps on Mindanao and other locations.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly security force assistance is way more central to our strategy than it had been in the past, and that's recognized in the, you know, it goes by various names, building partnership capacity and others. But certainly since when it was formalized, the 2006 Quadrennial Defense Review, it's recognized as central to a number of things we want to do around the world. Estimating the demand signal for the future, again, you know, is complicated for some of the reasons you may have alluded to, which is what countries can tolerate in some cases. You might like to supply more, but this is all they'll accept. So can you achieve your effects with that? But the growth in SOF was essential for lots of reasons. partner capacity being one of them, but just to build this network that we needed. There are things that SOF can't do or shouldn't do in security force assistance, whether it's technical, conventional, you know, I'm going to air defense training, I'm going to teach them how to use Patriots or whatever it is, or basic training, or when the demand becomes too big, as we have in Iraq and Afghanistan, where I need thousands of advisors to build an army, then you know, I have to find those wherever I can get them. But then the question is, should I make that a permanent part of my institution, or should I, how often do I think I'm going to do that? So the real driver is more the continuous demand around the world, and then how much insurance do you want to buy for the surge. I don't think we need, let me put it this way. There's multiple ways to look at that problem of however big people who would do security force assistance outside SOF are, that they have the opportunity to do so, whether it's training or advising, that their career paths allow them to succeed within their larger service. Are some of the fundamental issues. There are lots of benefits one could get from having some of that rather than gobs of it, but you have to institutionally manage it. You know, the demand numbers like 20,000 or 30,000 are just numbers. I mean, whether the answer should be 2,000 or, you know, I mean, there's order of magnitude differences there in the debate right now. So I would, and whether, how much of that you can actually do with existing units, even though it's an inefficient way of doing business rather than creating more specialized things. So we're, you know, the department is wrestling with that. It's been doing it through this past year. And we've got a number of studies on it.
Bob Lakin from the Nixon Center. You mentioned earlier that in any war there are allies of convenience, and in this one there are. I wonder if I can entice you onto the grounds of politics, not the war of ideas or the military, but somewhere in between. In the political world, terrorist groups find themselves in an adversarial relationship with fundamentalists, Salafists, political Islam. Some people think that political Islam or the Muslim Brotherhood are long-term allies and they shouldn't be allies. Others think, no, they are allies of convenience. I wonder whether you can address that.
Yeah, I mean, that's too specific about you know, for me to assess how enduring, how that partnership manifests itself in various areas and how enduring it might be. You know, I would say that any war, one of the laws of strategy is you know, conservation of enemies. Don't make more than you have to, and get as many friends as you can on your side against those enemies, right? And I mean, that's one of the advantages we actually have over Al Qaeda, is they seem to like to take on the world. You know, they don't like anybody, and so but the idea that you will have foreign policy goals in conflict, and the idea that from our side that you can win wars, whether it's World War II or others, by saying I'm only gonna play with guys that are just like me or I like, is, you know, historically not very accurate. But it's also, for this kind of war where you have to deal with the world as it is across the world, and you know it's, politics is local. Well, this is a case where war is local and global at the same time. You know, you have to deal with lots of partners and look at your goals, what can be short-term, what is long-term, and, you know, to get the security effects that you need. And it's a difficult balancing act for our policymakers. And then I would say the same thing is true on the other side, in a sense that, you know, you get very strange marriages where you see that people say, well, today we'll work together, but you're next. After I get rid of this guy, you know, I'm getting rid of you too. And you know, it's the way it works. So, all right.
Perhaps it is the sign of an excellent event. There are so many questions that we cannot get to them all. For those of you that we didn't get to, I apologize. Please join me in thanking Mike Vickers for taking the time to talk to us today.